This morning, we will look at outer space. Once again, it is not difficult to see the handiwork of a creator God when you look at this area. I want us to consider three things this morning: the dimensions, the design, and the decision. First of all, the dimensions. The size and scope of the universe is staggering. Just what we know about, and we really have no way of knowing how little of the universe we do know about, but just what we do know about is almost unbelievable in its enormity. We can only attempt to understand the vastness of the universe through feeble analogies. Suppose you could go 1,000 miles for a penny, but it costs you 1 cent to go 1,000 miles. Then a trip around the world would cost you 25 cents. Cost you 1/4 to go all the way around the world. A trip to the moon would cost you $2.40. A trip to the sun, if you paid a penny for every 1,000 miles, a trip to the sun would cost you $930. A trip to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system, at a penny for every 1,000 miles, would cost you $260 million. If you wanted to make a scale model of the nearest part of our solar system, you would need to make a tiny speck to represent the Earth. Just 5/8 of an inch away, you would need to place another tiny speck to represent the moon, just 5/8 of an inch away. Just 19 feet away, you would place a tiny ball to represent the sun. And then to represent the closest star, you would need to place a little ball 1,000 miles away. Distances in space are so vast that they are measured in light years. Light travels at the rate of 186,000 miles per second. Actually, a little faster than that, but rounded down to 186,000 miles per second. That means in the course of a year, light will travel 6 trillion miles. The speed of light is so fast that a bullet shot at that speed and encircling the globe, traveling around the Earth, would hit you 15 times before you fell to the Earth, even if it took you less than 2 seconds to fall. That's how fast the speed of light is. 186,000 miles per second. At that speed, it would take you only about 1 1/3 seconds to reach the moon. But to cross the Milky Way, just one galaxy, at the speed of light, would take you almost 120,000 years at the speed of light. They tell us that our galaxy alone contains more than 100 billion stars. Just our galaxy. More than 100 billion stars. And yet space is so vast that the space between one star and the next is sometimes 40,000 light years apart. They tell us that our universe has more than 100 billion galaxies. Our galaxy alone contains more than 100 billion stars, and yet they tell us our universe contains more than 100 billion galaxies. Think of that. More than 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and the universe has more than 100 billion stars. They tell us there are approximately 100 billion trillion stars that we know about, that we can study 100 billion trillion stars. Now consider this. They tell us that the most distant galaxies that they have discovered are traveling away from us at the speed of light. In all directions, our universe, our known universe, is expanding at 186,000 miles per second. In all directions, it's expanding away from us, and has been for as long as we know. The average star, according to astronomers, radiates energy at the rate of 521 sextillion horsepower. The average star. A sextillion is a 1 followed by 21 zeros. You have 100 billion trillion stars, all radiating on average 521 sextillion horsepower. In the 1940s, an eminent astronomer wrote, "The hypothesis of simultaneous creation will not stand up under serious criticism." But now even unsaved scientists concede that the evidence points towards simultaneous creation. Hugh Ross, an astronomer and author, says that astronomers who do not believe in God are becoming rare. Outer space is mind-boggling. The sun is actually a star, or the stars are actually suns, depending on how you want to look at it. Consider the size of the sun, just one sun, our sun, this morning. It is 860,000 miles across, over 100 times as wide as the Earth. They say if the sun were hollow, 1 million Earths would easily fit inside. 1 million Earths. And the sun is a comparatively small star. The sun is one of the smaller stars. We have a star in our galaxy, Antares, which is 150 million miles across, approximately 170 times as big as our sun, 150 miles across, just in its width, 170 times as wide. They have calculated that the sun is shrinking at a rate of at least 1.5 kilometers a year, or a little less than a mile a year, and that's the most conservative calculation. If that shrinking has been constant, and they have measured it for many, many years now, and it seems to be fairly constant, then the solar system cannot be billions of years old, as the evolutionists claim. 1 million years ago, the sun would have been twice its diameter, and life on Earth would have been unbearably hot. 210 million years ago, which is a very small time frame in the evolutionist time frame, they speak in billions of years. Just 210 million years ago, the sun would have been touching the surface of the Earth. That's only one of some 30-plus evidences for a young Earth and solar system in contradiction to the evolutionist guesses. We don't have time to get into that area of study this morning. But there are many, many, many scientific evidences for a very young Earth and solar system. Very tremendous proof that this Earth is perhaps 8 to 10,000 years old. The more we learn and discover, the more we find out we don't know very much. And a lot of what scientists think that they know is wrong and constantly changing. Here's an article, clumps of quasars detected. In another discovery troubling the current theory, a German X-ray telescope orbiting Earth has detected strong evidence indicating the extensive clustering of quasars, mysterious luminous objects thought to lie at the heart of some galaxies. In the last 2 years, the discovery of extremely large conglomerations of galaxies in more recent time has raised serious questions about a theory on the evolution of galactic structure called the cold dark matter model. Dr. Gunther Heisinger of the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics said the mere existence of such large structure is not compatible with many of the cold dark matter theories. If this is true, it might only cause a bigger problem for the theory. According to the reigning Big Bang theory, which holds that the universe began in an explosive instant, all matter and energy expanded in an incredibly smooth condition, and it is difficult to understand how the universe eventually changed to the clumpiness seen today, with not only galaxies and clusters of galaxies, but also strings of galactic clusters stretching hundreds of millions of light years. Subsequent observations and conjecture indicate that nearly 90% of the universe's mass has never been detected. Dr. Alan Dressler, an astronomer at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, said the cold dark matter theory, though still attractive, might be within a few observations of being abandoned altogether. In the 19th century, the telescope was invented. Before that, Hipparchus said that there were 1,022 stars. Ptolemy said, no, you're wrong, there are actually 1,056. Kepler said, you miscounted, there are really only 1,055. Jeremiah, centuries before that, said there are too many to count, they're innumerable. Once again, the Bible has proved to be right. No legitimate scientific discovery has ever contradicted the Bible. Plenty have contradicted science textbooks. The Bible is timeless and always right. The Bible makes no claim to be a science textbook, but in every place it speaks of science, it speaks authoritatively, and it speaks correctly, and it has never been disproven. We've looked briefly at the dimensions of space. Literally, we haven't even looked at the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. Space is overwhelmingly vast. I want us to consider the design of space as well this morning. It is incredible to contemplate the size of space, but what about design? Were the sun and moon and stars just randomly flung out in space, or is there design and order and structure to our universe? Scientists have listed over 50 different factors that must exist for life to be possible. Those 50 plus areas must have values falling within narrowly defined ranges concerning the universe in general, and our galaxy and sun, earth, and moon system in particular for life to be possible. Over 50 characteristics with narrowly defined ranges. Over 50. You think it's all accidental? Did it happen chance? Do you think it's coincidental? The mathematical odds against that are far greater than we can conceive. The number would be higher than any number we could calculate. These parameters have been discovered by many astronomers and physicists and specialists. They have been scientifically evaluated by the secular world and verified by unsaved scientists. This is not something that was invented or discovered by a Christian to show an all-wise creator. This list of parameters and boundaries is constantly growing. They had two parameters that they knew about in 1966 concerning our galaxy. Just two. They had eight by 1969. They had 23 by 1979. They had 30 by 1989. And more are being discovered every year. Many of the items on the list are too technical for this morning's message and would take too much time. But just by looking at a few of these areas this morning, it should be enough to show any objective person that this world that we live in has been fine-tuned to the nth degree, just right for life to exist. Biochemists tell us that for life molecules to operate so that organisms can live requires an environment where liquid water is stable. This means that a planet cannot be too close to its star or too far away. In the case of planet Earth, a change in the distance from the sun as small as 2%, as small as 2%, would rid the planet of all life. The Earth's biosphere is perfectly poised between a runaway freeze-up and a runaway evaporation. If the mean temperature of the Earth's surface cools by even a few degrees, more snow and ice will form. Snow and ice reflect solar energy much more readily than other surface materials. So then the reflection of more energy would translate into even lower temperatures, which means that more snow and ice would form, and the downward spiral would continue, resulting in an eventual complete freeze if just the mean temperature of the Earth were to lower by just a few degrees. On the other hand, if the mean temperature of the Earth's surface warms just a few degrees, more water vapor and carbon dioxide collect in the atmosphere. This extra water vapor and carbon dioxide create a greenhouse effect, which in effect warms up the temperature even more, causes the surface temperature to rise again, resulting in more evaporation, which causes the temperature to rise again, which would result in more evaporation, and on and on and on. You don't need to fear those things. God has made the earth just right. If you're not saved, the only global warming you need to fear is the day of the Lord, when the elements will melt with fervent heat and the earth will be destroyed by fire. The rotation period of a life-supporting planet must also fall within narrow boundaries. The planet takes too long to rotate. Temperature differences between day and night would be too great, hundreds of degrees. On the other hand, if a planet rotates too rapidly, then wind velocities will rise to catastrophic levels. By way of example, Jupiter takes only 10 hours to rotate, and a calm day on Jupiter generates 1,000 mile per hour winds because of that 10-hour rotation period. If the Earth's crust were just 10 feet thicker than it is, that much additional matter would have oxidized, they tell us, all the free oxygen out of the air. If the Earth's crust were too thin, volcanic and tectonic activity would be too great for life to exist. Our Earth moves around the sun in a fixed, established elliptical orbit. If our world were to slow down, we would be pulled too close at the shallow part of that Earth to the sun, and we would be burned to a crisp. If we were to speed up appreciably at the far ends of that orbit, it would throw us so far into space that we would freeze to death. The moon is about 240,000 miles from the Earth. Say if the moon, which governs the tides, had been placed only 50,000 miles from the Earth, the resulting tidal waves would go over the top of the Rocky Mountains. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is a spiral galaxy. Only 5% of the known galaxies are spirals. The other 95% are elliptical or irregular. In irregular galaxies, there are still active nuclei that spew out life-destroying radiation and material. We know now that most galaxies are not the right kind to possibly support life. We have spent hundreds of millions of dollars searching for intelligent life in outer space. Every recent discovery has indicated that that search is almost certainly in vain, in spite of what you may have read in the National Enquirer. Former Senator William Proxmire said that we would have been far wiser spending those hundreds of millions of dollars searching for intelligent life in Washington, D.C. The temperature of a planet and its surface gravity determine what's called the escape velocity, a measure of which atmospheric gases dissipate outer space and which are retained. For a planet to support life, it is essential that water vapor with a molecular weight of 18 be retained, while molecules as heavy as methane with a molecular weight of 16 and ammonia with a molecular weight of 17 dissipate. Change in surface gravity and temperature of just a few percent will make the difference. There's not much margin for error. There's so many areas we could look at. They tell us that if there were more than one star in our planetary system, if there were two suns we orbited, life on Earth would be impossible. If our sun were redder or bluer in color than it is, then photosynthetic response would be insufficient to sustain life. If our axial tilt were greater or less, they tell us life would be impossible. If our magnetic field were stronger, life could not exist. If it were weaker, life could not exist. Our oxygen to nitrogen ratio in the atmosphere has to be just right. Our carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere has to be just right for life to exist. There are many more areas we could look at: oxygen quantity, oceans to continents ratio, soil mineralization, and on and on and on. In addition to these areas that we now know about, scientists are currently studying about a dozen other parameters in order to establish what boundaries are necessary for life to be possible. Areas such as atmospheric transparency, mantle and core constituency, temperature gradient, pressure, etc., etc. It is entirely possible that before they are done, they will have discovered over 100 parameters in a number of different areas, parameters within which the Earth and Sun and Moon and our solar system must fall and remain for life to be sustained. Many of these parameters have no give or leeway in them at all. For some of them, the rate of variance possible is measured in fractions of 1%. And yet we fall right within those boundaries, right within those guidelines. Somehow, some way, the Earth and Sun and Moon just fell just right for every single one of those parameters. Those parameters weren't thought up by some preacher. Secular scientists acknowledge them, have discovered them, believe them, and teach them. Fred Hoyle is a scientist who has written extensively against Christianity. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, he discovered an incredible fine-tuning of the nuclear ground state energies for helium, beryllium, carbon, and oxygen that was necessary for any kind of life to exist. As a result of that, his conclusion was this, and I quote, "A super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology." Scientist Davies has gone from promoting atheism to stating this: the laws of physics seem themselves to be the product of exceedingly ingenious design. He goes on to say, "There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming." Astronomer George Greenstein wrote, "As we survey all the evidence, the thought insistently arises that some supernatural agency, or rather agency with a capital A, must be involved. Is it possible that suddenly, without intending to, we have stumbled upon scientific proof of the existence of a supreme being? Was it God who stepped in and so providentially crafted the cosmos for our benefit?" Tony Rothman, a theoretical physicist, wrote, "When confronted with the order and beauty of the universe and the strange coincidences of nature, it's very tempting to take the leap of faith from science into religion. I am sure many physicists want to." Arno Penzias, who won a Nobel Prize in physics, remarked, "Astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan." Cosmologist Edward Harrison said, "Here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God. The design argument of Paley, updated and refurbished, the fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. Take your choice. Blind chance that requires multitudes of universes, or design that requires only one. Many scientists, when they admit their views, incline toward the design argument." Alan Sandage, an astronomer, said, "I find it quite improbable that such order came out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but it is the explanation for the miracle of existence, why there is something instead of nothing. Robert Griffiths, mathematical physicist, said this: if we need an atheist for a debate, I go to the philosophy department. The physics department isn't much use. Meaning, of course, that the men in that department, the physics department, are becoming increasingly convinced of the existence of God. Astrophysicist Robert Jastrow is an agnostic. His observation is perhaps the most telling of all. He said, for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. We have looked at the dimensions. We have looked at the design. And now we come to our final point, the decision. The decision. Psalms 33:6 says, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made. Psalms 102:25, the heavens are the work of thy hands. Nehemiah 9:6, thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host. Proverbs 3:19, by understanding hath he established the heavens. Psalms 19:1-3 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Psalms 8:3-4, David said, when I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? The decision? The decision's up to you. What are you going to do with God this morning?